I predicted that Rupert Lowe would be removed in November. You'll see if there's a tweet on my timeline where I said that Rupert Lowe is looking very able and so on, and he should be careful he doesn't get Nigel. I think axing him is an extraordinary act of self-sabotage. For me, I look at it and go, yep, that is the continuation of the way things were run back in the old days. I felt that the behaviour of the people on the board of the party, the great majority of them, looked to me like a well-organised campaign of party self-destruction. I cannot say to you which organisations people work for. Generally, I would say that infiltration, it's been a strong suit of British intelligence agencies for a long time. There's a lot of moles out there in just about any organisation, you know, that starts to become successful and potentially a threat to the powers that be. Promotion in the mainstream parliamentary parties in the UK comes down to how compromised you are. Quips promoted people that they have by the short and curlies, and unfortunately that means that they promote the people who are actually, you know, let's just say, a little bit more sinful than the others.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Richard Brain, who was briefly the leader of the UK Independence Party between August 2019 and October 2019, where it seems he left on a matter of principle with regard to the treatment of a particular member. And we're going to talk about the UK Independence Party and why these groups seem to was degenerate into infighting and such like interesting stuff. Richard, hello.
Hello, very very nice to be here. Thank you for having me on the show, and I'm looking forward to chatting to you.
Yes, pleasure. Okay, so tell me, how did you first get involved in the old Eurosceptic politics?
I think, well, back in the 90s, I did a little bit of volunteering for the referendum party. I always felt that it was a tower of Babel, and that that to try to pretend that Europe could, you know, ultimately become a single country was folly. I mean, I felt that, you know, Europe was really characterized primarily by its extraordinary diversity of peoples and languages and cultures and histories and geographies and economies and politics. So I really felt that the only way that Soviet style project could be achieved was by trying to bash everything into the same shape, which I thought would be very bad for the countries and the people and the continent of Europe. So that's why I was sort of inclined in that direction. And so then when Jimmy Goldsmith died, I started to vote for the UK Independence Party. But I didn't actually join up until 2015, about 6 months before the referendum, when I saw that we had a chance to actually have a vote. I had been voting for that for 15, 20 years or something, but I never thought that opportunity would actually arise. So when it came, I thought, well, you have to get up and do something and put your money where your mouth is. You voted for it. It's here. Get on with it. And so that's why I joined UKIP and started to campaign campaigned quite vigorously during the referendum itself, which of course was...
You joined UKIP quite a long time after. Jimmy Goldsmith, didn't he die in the late 90s?
90s, yes. Parliament. So a lot of people have forgotten that in 1997, the referendum party got about a million votes in the election that saw Tony Blair elected for the first time. And so it was, that was quite a lot of votes. And it was, you know, it was really noticed but Jimmy Goldsmith, sadly, didn't last much longer after that. I think he died of pancreatic cancer or something like that. Anyway, so at that point, the referendum party sort of dissolved, and I think UKIP sort of became the flag bearer for the cause of getting away from these gangsters that run the European Union. So yes, so I supported it for a long time, but I didn't really become active until 2015, 2016, and of course the glorious referendum itself, which was such an unexpected triumph and really offered an extraordinary hope for Britain to become properly independent again of these, supranational movements and forces and secret, you know, organizations with unlimited funds and who knows who was pulling the levers of them. It's still the case today, I think, that, governments all over the world seem to be influenced by external forces that we aren't really allowed to know very much about. But So that was how I got involved. It was obvious to me when we won the referendum that since there'd been, I think, 15 plebiscites in the EU that had gone against the EU, and they had all been ignored, every single one of them, including, for instance, in France, where they voted non in 2005. And in 2007, the French Parliament simply ratified an almost identical treaty that had been rejected by the French people, I think 55% against. And the French Parliament just said, well, we've put a new name on the top of it, so now we're going to sign it, and we're not going to consult the people this time, because they were terribly inconvenient 2 years ago when we asked them pretty much, well, in fact, exactly the same question, because the text of the treaty was really more or less identical. And so, you know, that's a pretty obvious case of directly, you know, flagrantly flying in the face of what the people want. And so because we'd seen that, I decided after the referendum result that I would have to continue campaigning, because it was so unlikely that that the British government and the parliament and all the powers that be, who were so obviously rabidly against against leaving the EU, it was so unlikely that they would actually honor their promise. And so that's why I stayed in UKIP, to try to keep the pressure on the traitor class in Westminster, you know, to keep the pressure on them to say, you actually have to deliver what you said this vote was about, and what you said you were going to give us. So that's why I kept going, and found myself by sort of 2019, really without ever intending to be there, I found myself in a position where what was going on in the party as regards its leadership was very disappointing. I think that, you know, the candidates, some of the candidates were in that 2019 leadership election, which I stood in, were, you know, I think very, very substandard people. You have Ben Walker, the current chairman of UKIP, been chairman for the last 5-6 years, whatever it is. You know, he's a convicted criminal. He's a very unpleasant and I think the dangerous person. And certainly, you know, he has run the party into the ground. I don't know how many.
What's he convicted of?
He was convicted of bad building practices. He built a dangerous, as I understand it, it was reported in Bristol local news, but I think he was convicted of building a dangerous extension or modification to a house down in that somewhere there in the West Country. You can look it up. It is available online, so you can find. I actually had a copy of the court judgment, and was assured by a barrister that it is actually a criminal conviction. But he don't forget, he was reported by Guido Fawkes as having tried to bargain for the chairmanship of the party by offering, I think it was Henry Bolton, a share of the chairman's salary. The leader of UKIP doesn't get paid. The chairman does get paid. The leader supposedly chooses the chairman. But what I discovered when I was leader is that's an illusion, and you can't actually change the chairman after all, even though the constitution says you can. And so it became clear to me when I was leader that the role of leader is really more, you know, that you're a sort of puppet, really. You have to do what you're told.
Well, on the subject of law and order, I mean, they took you to court, didn't they, unsuccessfully, as I understand.
They took me to court, yes. So, I mean, this is an extraordinary case. It's a perfect example of lawfare, I suppose, that some people in the NEC decided that they wanted rid of me, I think, before I was actually elected, or at least certainly by the time of the first NEC meeting. It was obvious that the people in the meeting were not going to allow me to make any decisions or do anything of any sort of positive, with any positive outcome. By the time I'd been in place sort of two months, they falsely accused me of, I suppose, data theft would be the best description of what they accused me of. The claim they made was that I had committed data theft by going into UKIP's head office and asking the secretary to send an email from me to the members of the party who had elected me as leader, 53% overwhelming, in a four-way race. It was a landslide win for the leadership. That to send an email to them simply stating these are the names of the 20 or so members who have put themselves forward for election to the NEC. And that is all that the email said, nothing else at all. And they put a case to the court that by sending that email, I had carried out data theft, and that as the leader of the party, I hadn't the right to send an email to the members of the party from its head office. It's the most absolutely preposterous case. It was incredible stupidity. I think just downright malfeasance. You know, it was just trying to find anything to attack me for in my courts. It took 9 months. I represented myself. We had the court case thrown out. At the final hearing, their barrister argued that the threshold for throwing it out should be whether the case was fanciful. And the judge agreed with me and anybody sensible looking at it. The case was absolutely fanciful. It wasn't just fanciful. It was preposterous. There was no evidence. Yeah. It was absolutely...
Odd allegations emerging to try and undermine someone senior in the party. It reminds me of something else.
Well, it was a success. They successfully removed me from the leadership of the party. So they spent about £100,000, I would guess, of members' money doing that. This is member subscriptions. And I shouldn't think any of those members, or certainly very few of those members, had contributed their money with the purpose of having the NEC take the leader to the High Court on the grounds that they did. So yes, there is does seem strangely familiar to what's been going on recently. But the case was thrown out. They were ordered to pay my costs, and they still 5 years later. And my costs, by the way, were only about £2,000, since because I was a litigant in person. I think I was paid £19 an hour or something for defending myself, and they still haven't paid it. You know, and Ben Walker, the chairman, and whoever's there in the party now with their tiny number of voters and all the branches shut down and nothing really going on except the occasional legacy coming in from someone who left a legacy to UKIP in his will, which is probably the real reason for keeping the party going, and it would be my guess. So those people are still there, and they've never paid the costs that the judge ordered them to pay in 2020. So I'm still owed money, and they don't respond. Yeah. So
you refused to go to the, as the leader, you refused to go to the UKIP conference. I read in September 2019 because of their treatment of another chap I've interviewed called Gerald Batten.
That is incorrect. I did not refuse to go to the conference. I said that the conference, I would attend the conference if they did a sensible thing, which is return Gerard Batten to simply the status of being an ordinary member who was not suspended. And it's not really clear why, even particularly, that they suspended him. You know, it was just internecine warfare. I mean, Gerard Batten was a founder of the party back in, one of the very earliest people to join back in 91 or 92, whenever it was. He had been an MEP for 14 years. He's a very decent, very loyal member. He's a very clever and intelligent, interesting man. And he did a lot of good, including writing two books on how you can actually leave the European Union unilaterally, which was a very good policy for the party to have. And so Gerard was a great member of the party, and I admired him tremendously. And so to treat him the way they did was absolutely appalling. And you know, the people who were treating him like that were, who were they? I mean, many of them weren't even supposed to be on the NEC because they'd outstayed their terms and managed to sort of pretend that they didn't have to have re-elections to stay on the NEC. So the way he was terrible, and I felt as leader that this terrible treatment of him had to stop, and that he should be regarded as a member in full standing. And I said, stop persecuting this guy, bring him back into being a full member in full standing. You know, let him speak at the conference. There's nothing wrong with him. You know, and I'll attend the conference and, you know, do my job and be, you know, 100% there for the party. But the problem was that the party was being run by a group of people who, by my judgment, were almost certainly there to annihilate it, and they've pretty much achieved that. So I think, you know, by their fruits shall ye know them. I don't know how many members UKIP has now, but it's probably smaller than your local gym membership. It's gone. You know, the party has been annihilated.
Let's look at that. Why is it that you was what possible reason would there be people there in order to annihilate it?
Well, people ask me this question, and the answer to this is very simple. At the time, I would say, does UKIP have any enemies? And I think we can all understand that it had at that time, it had quite a lot of enemies. I don't need to list them. We're looking at political parties, possibly governments, possibly other organizations, NGOs, the European Union itself. Who knows who was involved in infiltration of UKIP? Who knows who was involved in making sure that it disappeared? I still felt at that time that it was the best platform for trying to achieve exit from the European Union, which is why I was there. And remember, that was 2019, before we had even technically left. Although, many would argue that there's a lot of unfinished business there as regards actually leaving the European Union, diverging from some of its stupider policies. So that was the situation. I felt that the behavior of the people on the board of the party, the great majority of them, looked to me like a well-organized campaign of party self-destruction. I mean, I can give you so many examples of that. But in general, whenever I suggested, look, we need to do this, it's urgent, the party, this is how we're going to make the party thrive, every time anything like that was suggested, I would get a brick wall, just vote. There'd be two or three people only on the board, on the NEC, who would vote with me. And the usual suspects were just no, 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 no. And they achieved, I think, what they were. They were also, by the way, completely in breach of the party's rules. For example, the leader is supposed to be informed of all UKIP party meetings and is entitled to be present. But I can remember turning up for an NEC meeting, and I arrived a bit early, and some people were coming out of a meeting room, members of the party, some members of the NEC, and there was clearly some kind of junta carrying out meetings without my knowledge, presumably discussing the means by which they were going to remove me and annihilate the party. It was CFIT, controlled flight of the brain.
It's consistent with the conspiracy theory, then, that it, and perhaps now Reform, really are controlled opposition, that they're infiltrated. I mean, I'm always arguing, but a lot of my followers are some of them are quite into conspiracy theories. I tend not to think like that. I think in a more mechanical way, for whatever reason. I find it difficult. I think that it's very difficult for a large scale conspiracy to not be rumbled, but a small scale conspiracy with a small number of people is more possible. And we know they happen. I mean, the cover-up of Lord Boothby, for example, by the press and so forth, and his connection to the Craze, that was a conspiracy which wasn't uncovered until 1986. So these things can happen. And it almost implies that UKIP really are what their opponents, the BNP or whatever, said they were, which is a state-controlled safety valve somehow, and that is allowed to get reasonably popular, but not too popular, and that somehow this game has to be played.
I think that's possible. Certainly, I look at what's been going on in Reform. By the way, I should just point out that I did not join Reform after I was removed from UKIP. And so I did not feel that Reform had the sort of party structure that I would like to see if I were going to contribute significant effort to a political party. I do think that a party does need to have branches, elected chairman of branches, elected members to in any positions of authority. That a party should be grassroots. It should have a democratic constitution and structures. There need to be rules about how the members of the party actually achieve representation from the people that wield any sort of power in the party. I think it's a principle that if you're going to be a successful party in a democratic country, or the democratic process, that you should actually adopt democratic principles yourselves in the party. And so I do I do believe in that, and that's one of the reasons why I've never joined Reform, is that it's fairly obvious that it's nothing of the sort, and that it's really just a dictatorship. There's one, or there's possibly two or three people influential at the top level, but ultimately that seems to be the structure of it. And I think that's what we've seen recently. Unfortunately, the supporters of Rupert Lowe, you know, you're hosed. You know, he doesn't have, he's not represented. You know, you'd be see turfed out of the party on the say so of, you know, one or two people.
And attacked legally. I mean, they're kind of using lawfare against him. It reminds me a little bit of what you experienced. There are parallels. Well,
I certainly would say that. By the way, I would point out that I predicted that Rupert Lowe would be removed in November. You'll see there's a tweet on my timeline where I said that Rupert Lowe is looking very able and so on, and he should be careful he doesn't get Nigel'd. That's what I said in my tweet, and it was obviously tongue in cheek. But I think the problem here is that while Nigel Farage has done a great amount for the movement, and don't forget how many, you know, for two and a half decades or so, he was going around to town halls all over England and the UK to speak to audiences, very often of three or four people, carrying their supermarket bags or whatever it was, you know, a very informal and unglamorous and hard work existence to try to get enough people to get out and campaign for this. So I do not underestimate his extraordinary efforts and also his extraordinary talent at going onto the media and debating and communicating political ideas and intentions. So, you know, he is a remarkable person and certainly a celebrity. And he has certainly, got through to the British people in a most important way. So don't get me wrong. But I think the downside is that for one reason or another, he has not managed to put together teams of like-minded people who are capable of properly organizing a movement and turning it into a really successful political party that breaks through in the way that Labour did in the early part of the 20th century. The question is, what happens? Why doesn't that work out? And the removal of Rupert Lowe, I think, is a perfect example of what happens and why it goes wrong. And that's why, you know, I predicted this in November. It has come to pass. It's, for me, it was entirely expected. And the reason is that I've seen a great many talented, interesting, able, conviction, people with real convictions who have worked really, really hard, many of them, for the various political parties, whether it be UKIP or whether it be Brexit Party Reform or you know, whichever other parties it may have been. But I've seen a lot of those people being completely disenfranchised. I mean, we see it now with the branches of Reform, where really hardworking, really committed branch chairmen are just literally being cast aside, or being thrown away. This is a terribly destructive thing to do, a terrible waste of resources, experience, you know, the commitment of people and their belief. It's utterly demoralizing for people who had got their hopes up and hadn't realized that the Reform Party was going to be run in that way. And I feel very sorry for them. It's been a very ugly learning process. For me, I look at it and go, yep, that is the continuation of the way things were run back in the old days.
Let's go back to that. So Gerald Batten, when I interviewed him about this a few days ago, told me that Nigel was always basically the de facto leader of the party. Although they had people like, I mean, this is before you were in it, obviously, but they had people like Roger Natman or whatever overt leaders. And he was saying, yeah, but Nigel was always basically in charge. He was like the Deng Xiaoping. You know, Deng Xiaoping was the deputy minister for transport, but everybody knew who was in charge of China. And it was kind of like that. And so what's odd about it is the way that whenever they did something brilliant, So 2009, they do really, really well in the European elections. And so he resigns. At the point they're doing something brilliant, he's got really got somewhere, momentum, off he goes, and they let in Lord Pearson, and Lord Pearson even said that he didn't think he was a very good politician. And then Farage comes back in and runs the party again from 2010 to 2016. They win the referendum, they win it, momentum, resigns.
And don't forget Nigel. Yeah, he resigned the following day, and when I saw that, you know, I was horrified. I thought, listen, this is the moment. You know, you've just breached the gates of the castle. You know, now is the moment when you pour everybody into it and take charge. This is the moment where you've got to now be looking for the next general election, getting really well organized, getting funded, making sure that you're on the top of your game, getting out there in the press and really getting the party embedded in people's minds. This is the solution. So when I saw him resign on the 24th of June in 2016, I just thought, this is, you know, it's like watching a pilot in a dogfight, you know, let go of the controls and put on some, you know, put on some of those flight, you know, when you're going to go to sleep on a flight, put those on and say, okay, I'm out of here. I really felt that was, I could not understand why he did that. I thought it was incredibly mysterious, tactically, strategically, incredibly mysterious way to behave. We've seen it, as you say, over and over again. Look, you know, he's fought very hard. You know, this is a man who sat in, seven Westminster parliamentary elections. And I think the eighth time, wasn't it, that you finally became an MP? You know, he's only been an MP for a year or whatever it is.
When I can't find enough base knowledge to feed the inner workings of my mind, and I go on to Audible, and all I can find is warmed-up diarrhea by people like Adam Rutherford and Angela Saini, I sometimes don't know what to do. But that's why I use Legion.com. Legion.com gets the most based books, summarises them into key salient points, and reads them to you in 25 enthralling minutes, whether it's my own books or whether it's Who We Are and How We Got Here by David Reich, a fascinating book which allows us to understand in much more depth the evolution of man using archaeogenetics, taking old skeletons, analysing the different alleles and telling you exactly how we evolved. Whatever based book it is, Legion.com is the one for me.
He stood for Parliament seven times, as I understand. I think it was his eighth time of standing that he finally became an MP, which I think a lot of people are very happy about. It's been a long time coming. I think for many of us, we see the very hard work of Rupert Lowe in Parliament as an MP, and that's come as something, you know, very refreshing. And his ability to ask the right questions and difficult questions in Parliament, I think many people admire. And these are the questions that are never really asked by the press when they should be. They're not being, you know, asked by MPs when they should be. I think that really those two groups are failing in their duty to the British people to ask those sorts of questions. And so that's why I think Rupert Lowe has quickly built up a strong support, rightly he deserves it. And I think, yes, I think axing him is an extraordinary act of self sabotage. I know that I've read somewhere that Nigel said something that Rupert Lowe's followers were mostly sort of, you know, far right people on social media and so on. Well, that may or may not be the case, but certainly I think that a lot of people I know are aware of this situation, and fairly mystified by, you know, when you only have your first five MPs as a party to chop one of them off like that when he appears to be doing an excellent job is an extraordinary move. But then, as we know, there's a lot more to this than just some kind of dissatisfaction with Rupert Lowe or his...
As a person that's been the leader of a party like this and has been been subject to the chicanery involved, what is your instinct as to what on earth there is to this?
Well, look, you know, you're asking me to speak about things that I can only speculate over. But I shall speculate, with the caution that's all I'm doing. I think that over the years I've seen that, talented people who have their own ideas and are intelligent and can stand on their own two feet, don't last all that long under the Nigel Farage umbrella. It may be that in his very difficult role, it may be that he has to have, people who are loyal to the point of sycophancy. That maybe that's what is required if you're going to achieve the sort of revolution that he achieved, or has at least perhaps partly achieved, along, by the way, with a large number of other good people in UKIP, certainly, and even also Tories. And even in my campaign group during the referendum, we even had some Lib Dems and Labour. So it wasn't just one party, but certainly, the UKIP faithful worked very, very long and hard to get to where the party was, and when it really started to threaten the Tories properly in between sort of 2010 and 2014, and to force Cameron's hand and require that referendum. So, Nigel has got where he is with the help of a very large number of supportive and hardworking people. I would say that on balance, there's quite often there are people around him who have talent, who end up, getting cast aside. I think that's the real failing of the movement. When I look back over the period, from the 90s and then right up to the important period in 2016 and subsequent to that, I see a pattern of failing to really consolidate the movement, despite a large amount of willpower and conviction and good people who really want to save this country from the fate that it is heading towards rapidly. Those people are not being brought together into a movement.
Because what good leaders do normally when they know they're going to have to go or their time is coming is they groom a successor, a competent successor, a successor that can carry on what they want to do. Two examples come to mind. Margaret Thatcher very much groomed John Major to be her successor, and then he replaced her. And Michael Howard very much groomed David Cameron to be his successor, and then he replaced him. That's what a good leader does. And so therefore you have to get that balance right between the people that are, yes, the people that are competent and charismatic and ambitious are kind of after your job, but at the same time you can't just get rid of them, because then when you go, because you've won the referendum and so it's time to resign or whatever, then there's nobody competent to take over, and you end up with infighting. And in UKIP, I mean, it was farcical for those of us that were watching it on telly. It was absolutely farcical. You had one woman that was a leader for like a couple of days before she declared she didn't really want to be leader, and
I think Diane was leader for about 18 days, but I know what you mean. It's not a very easy job stepping into those shoes. And Nigel certainly had many years of being despised by many people and being treated pretty rudely. And it brings you back to that idea that I can't remember. I think it might have been Parkinson or Tebbit. When The Witch Is Dead became number one in the charts after Margaret Thatcher's death, he said that she would have been delighted because upsetting and outraging the people that she strongly disagreed with and who were incapable of joining rational argument or answering to it was something that she relished. And I suppose that that's probably the case with a lot of people who were in the UKIP and the referendum movement, that in general, they were people who didn't mind being were strong enough to be attacked, were prepared to be attacked for what they believed in, and in fact were attacked in, by every institution, right from Cameron's government, all the parties, Westminster, the Lords, all of the NGOs, all of the corporations, the banks, who didn't come and even Obama flew over to come and tell us, tell us which way to vote and remind us that those people are going to be at the back of the queue. Silly little Englanders and whatever. So I think being attacked that way is, and in more vicious ways, is sort of par for the course. You sort of expect it. But that's the cost of sort of believing in something and trying to push through, get recognition for and bring to people's minds an idea, a political idea that isn't, mainstream or current or generally, widely accepted. So that's par for the course, but I think that Diane had a tough time. It was a pretty daunting job to become leader of UKIP, because you knew that you were going to be a figure of hate to a large number of people, not just in this country but overseas. So I think, and Nigel's got a very thick skin because of that. But as you say, I do think the failure to failure. I mean, look, it may be that Nigel felt that UKIP was so infiltrated that it was unsavable, and therefore the best thing to do was to destroy it.
By MI5, by the far left.
As I said to you earlier, I'm certain that UKIP had a lot of enemies throughout that period. They were queuing up. When I was in that NEC meeting room, facing that brick wall, I had no idea who those people were working for. I had a strong sensation that they were well organized and supported outside of that NEC, UKIP NEC meeting room. And that essentially, I was only seeing the tip of an iceberg. To give you an idea of that, I had planned to make chairman of the party, a lovely lady called Liz Phillips. And when I arrived at my first NEC meeting a week after being elected, there was a 40-page dossier, multiple copies, ring-bound, 40-page dossier about what an awful person she was on the NEC table, which I had not seen. And the chairman said, well, everybody's seen this, haven't you? And they all nodded and went, yeah, we've seen it. And I, as the leader, had not been shown this 40-page ring-bound dossier that had obviously been prepared by the existing chairman. There was organization going on behind the scenes, that was, and that kind of thing happened a few times, and I realized there's more going on here. This is, you can turn up as UKIP leader to a UKIP meeting, but really the actual activities are going on elsewhere, and you are not a party to it. My experience was pretty unequivocal that there are political machinations going on quite outside this realm that I'm supposed to be in charge of, and I'm actually not in charge of it for those reasons, and it's impossible for me to take charge of it for those reasons. So I cannot say to you who, which organizations, which groups, which factions people worked for. Generally, I would say that infiltration, we all know that it's been a strong suit of European, certainly British intelligence agencies for a long time. So it's going to happen. I'm sure it does happen a lot. There's a lot of moles out there in just about any organization, that starts to become successful and potentially, a threat to the powers that be.
You met Nigel a few times. What were your impressions of him? Is he the same as he comes across on the telly? Is he just the bon vivant, or is there slightly more depth?
I met him probably once or twice.
Are you ready for the future of the West?